Today's Keisho is on case 47 in the Book of Serenity, Zhao Zhou's Cypress Tree. Introduction: the cypress tree in the yard, the wind-blown flag on the pole, it's like one flower bespeaking a boundless spring, like one drop telling of the water of the ocean. The ancient Buddhas, born periodically, go far beyond the ordinary current, not falling into words and thought. How can you understand verbally? Case: a monk asked Zhao Zhou, what is the living meaning of Zen Buddhism? Zhao Zhou said, the cypress tree in the yard. Verse: the bank eyebrows lined with snow, the river eyes contain autumn, the ocean mouth drums waves, the boat tongue rides the current. The ability to quell disorder, the strategy for great peace. Old Zhao Zhou, old Zhao Zhou. Stirring up the monasteries, never yet stopping. Uselessly expending effort, still the cart is made to fit the groove. Originally without ability, still it fills the ravines and gullies. Everybody for doing such an excellent job this morning in the Zendo. We really sat very still. There was very little movement and it was very quiet, and people were sometimes struggling with this practice, which is challenging. But everybody did an excellent job without exception. It's very important not to there's a wonderful phrase which comes from the Civil War. There was a general in Abraham Lincoln's army during the American Civil War who was confronting the Confederate troops, the opposing side, in a battle. And he had every advantage going for him. He outnumbered the Southern forces. He was assured of a victory was almost certain, and the collapse of his opponents was just about to happen. But he decided that he didn't want an ordinary victory. He wanted an extraordinary victory. So he had this idea that he was going to tunnel underground and tunnel under the Confederate lines and put boxes of explosives under the Confederates and then blow them to smithereens. And basically, the Confederates could see all this digging going on. So they actually figured out what was going on, and they dug down. And the Northern Army was forced into defeat. And when Abraham Lincoln, the president of the United States, heard about this, he said, only General so-and-so could snatch a defeat from the jaws of victory. And I love that. I love that expression, because in some ways we do that all the time. We snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. So if you study for a test and you get a 97, you can say, oh, why didn't I get 100? You know, I don't know if you ever did that. Some people are happy to get a 97, but sometimes you think, oh my God, I should have gotten 100. I didn't do that good a job. And it's possible to be that way with your Zen practice too. You can set such a high standard for yourself that that you can never meet it. It's very important to realize that if you get through the sit, you should give yourself a big pat on the back, you know, that this is very challenging, and all you have to do is get through one breath at a time. You don't have to reach enlightenment during this sitting period. All you have to do is be present in the moment. If you get through the sit, you should just feel like you've won the lottery, if you don't mind my saying so. Today, this morning, everybody was doing really very well. people were sitting still, and on occasion, their legs got tired, and they stretched their legs or they shifted their posture. But that's okay. You know, it's okay to do that. And so it's counterproductive to be too judgmental on yourself when you're doing this kind of practice. I would say that Zen practice is all about learning how to trust. I mean, I can't think of any better word to describe Zen practice. Trust. When you sit down on the cushion, you know what to do. You straighten your back. You breathe through the hara. You watch the breath go out and back. And you're hoping to have some kind of an experience on the cushion that's going to be liberating or enlightening, right? But you really can't control the process. You come in, you sit down on the cushion, you watch the breath, and what happens during any particular sit is almost entirely beyond your control. Almost entirely. You know, we had a sit in, we had a sesshin at the end of May. And I was really having difficulty sitting. I was having a lot of pain in my legs, and when I would get up from the sit, I would be very stiff. And I really had no idea why this was happening. But when I would sit down, you know, my legs would start hurting me right away. And when I would get up, I would be, you know, so stiff I could, you know, I'd be almost limping. You know, during this, so far, during this sesshin, you know, I feel so limber and the sits have been really almost effortless. Now, why is that? What was going on in June and what's going on today? You know, I really don't know. I'm happy that my legs hurt less than they did in June, you know. And I don't know why. But I do trust the process of doing Zazen because it's helped me so much in my life. You know, I've come to many sesshins in great distress. You know, I've come to sesshins with all kinds of problems. And I've sat down on the cushion with all kinds of expectations about results, you know. And I can say that almost always when I finished the sesshin and gone home, I have felt better. Now, that hasn't always been true. There have been occasions where I've come back from sesshin and I've been disappointed in my performance. See? So I remember once I was working on a koan, which was the koan, what does the Buddha ride? This is not in the collection of koans, but it's a koan in our lineage. And the koan goes like this. Manjushri rides the lion, Samantapadra rides the elephant, what does the Buddha ride? Some of you have done this koan. And I worked on this koan and worked on it, and I sat extra. You know, when the sitting period was over, I would go back into the zendo, and I would sit. And I was raggedy, but, you know, in my mind, I had a story that was going to go like this. I would sit, and then on the last day I would go in to see the Roshi, I would go in to see the teacher, and I would present the answer, and he would go, "Ah, you did it! Good work." But it didn't work like that. I sat, and I had one last dokusan, and I went in to see the teacher, and he said, I don't remember what he said, but he wasn't impressed. So I didn't pass the koan, and I went home. And of course, when I was going home, other people were having such a good time at the end of the sesshin. They were so happy, and I had the feeling they all answered their koan but me. And so it kind of spoiled the sesshin for me because I went home feeling that I had not succeeded in and being a good Zen student. Maybe that's part of the koan, working with that particular koan in particular. But the point is that I snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. You know, when I sat down on the cushion and I watched my breath, there was the chance for me to stumble into the moment. And if I had stumbled into the moment 100%, I would have been free from all of these judgments I was applying to myself very harshly. You know, I think this is why I got into Zen to begin with. You know, my father in particular was like hypercritical. And he was very critical of most people in the universe. And he was very critical of me. And so, you know, I had learned how to be hypercritical of myself. You know, I think it stuck with me. You know, I was very, very demanding of myself. You know, and I had unrealistically high standards. I was one of these students who had to get straight A's in everything. And maybe this was because my father, I thought if I could get straight A's, it would please my father. But I didn't always manage to get straight A's. There were sometimes I just didn't get an A plus, you know. Sometimes I got a B. And for me, this was like a nightmare. I would think, oh my God, I've got to study harder. And I would actually be sort of ill. You know, I was an obsessive kid, you know. And so when I started doing Zen, it was quite refreshing to me. Because at first I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I would just sit on the cushion. You know, I had read all of these. I had read some books about Zen, and I had read these crazy books about Tibet. And I thought maybe if you did meditation, you could have mystical powers or something like that. So when I met my teacher Genki Roshi and I started doing Zazen, it wasn't at all what I expected. You know, there were no mystical teachings. There were no special lessons. You know, occult lessons or rituals. We didn't do any sand paintings. All we did was sit on the damn cushion and watch our breath. And it was totally mystifying for me. And I tried to watch my breath for years and years. And I had very little success apparently. But I didn't know what I was doing. And when I would finish a sesshin, even though I hadn't passed my koan, I would actually feel much better, and I wouldn't know why. And I realize now that there's something really quite special about sesshin and really quite special about zazen. You know, it's very difficult for people to be 100% in the moment. It's very difficult for us. It seems like the easiest thing to do. But it's actually quite difficult. When we sit down on the cushion, we bring with us often, though not always, we bring with us all kinds of expectations, conscious and unconscious. And so, you know, we might come to sesshin thinking that we're going to have a great breakthrough experience, or by the way, you could come to sesshin thinking you're going to fail. You know, it's possible to come to sesshin as a way of setting yourself up to fail. And so, you know, one way or the other, when we come to sesshin, we bring conscious and unconscious baggage to the cushion. And sometimes it can be very difficult, as we're supposedly doing our zazen, to be present in the moment because all of this stuff is going through our minds. We might be thinking, I'm 26 years old, and I'm not married yet. You know, all my friends are married, and I'm not married. And you could actually be sitting on the cushion thinking, what is it about me that the people don't find attractive? You know. Meanwhile, next next to you, there might be somebody thinking, why did I get married? I'm so young. I could have played the field, you know? I love my wife, I guess, you know? But now I'm in this relationship forever, you know? And it's so hard to be a good, you know, partner, and I never get to have any fun, you know? I want to go out and drink with the boys, or, you know, this stuff. I mean, this is human nature, right? So one person's sitting there going, oh, if only I were married, all my problems would be solved, right? And next to him is somebody thinking, oh, if only I weren't married, all my problems would be solved, right? You can do this game yourself anytime. In fact, you're probably playing it from time to time at the session. You know, you think, believe me, these are very, you know, people will be saying, I don't have a good job, you know, if only I could get into a firm, you know, one of these big firms where I'd have security, right? And I would, if only I could get into one of these big firms, I'd have security, and finally, you know, I'd have a job where I could get up in the morning, go to work at the same time every day, come home at the same time. And I know I'd have a lot of stress, but at least, you know, at least I'd have predictability in my life, you know? And that person could spend the whole session thinking like that. And then meanwhile, there's somebody else in the room going, oh my God, you know, 10 years or 15 years in this rat race, every day I get up, I drive to work, I go home at 5 o'clock, you know, this is hell, you know? Right? This is so human, right? This is the way people are, you know, sometimes. You know, we imagine our situation as undesirable for all kinds of reasons, and then we imagine that there's this other person who is living a life different from ours, and that person's totally fulfilled and happy. If only we had, you know, I've experienced this in my own life too. You know, when I finished college, I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted so badly to be a novelist. It was just really, I didn't really apply myself, but I thought to myself, you know, if I could just get a short story published, you know, I'd have done something. And I actually got a short story published, and then I thought if I could just get a novel published, you know. And I knew that if I could just publish a novel, all my problems would be solved, you know. And I used to read about writers and just think, you know, I think on some level I just envied them so much, you know. And I wanted to be a great writer. Meanwhile, if you actually read the lives of writers, you know, they actually have a very difficult life. You know, it's very solitary. It's very competitive. I was just reading something about Hemingway, and Ernest Hemingway was such an interesting person psychologically. When I was in college, everybody read Hemingway. He was like the god of literature. And his books are beautiful. Some of his, he has these short stories that are so beautiful. There's one called Big Two-Hearted River, and it's just about this guy who has some problems, and he goes fishing on the river. And he's doing trout fishing, and he's trying to work through his problems while he's trout fishing. And Hemingway basically says, you know, don't go too deep into the water. Just stay on the surface. That's my life advice to you, you know. At the time, I just thought, oh, this is brilliant, you know. But what I really loved about Hemingway was, I suppose, that Hemingway was so loved. You know, people adored Hemingway. And I thought, you know, to be Ernest Hemingway would be the most wonderful thing in the world. If I were Ernest Hemingway, I'd have millions of readers, admiring readers. You know, you walk down the street and everybody says, I love you, you're an important person. Yeah, that's what we're really all about, isn't it, you know? And then I recently was reading this story about Hemingway, this biography of Hemingway, and it turns out he was really, he really had problems because he didn't like being alone, and writing requires you to be alone. So Hemingway would start working on a novel, and he'd have to really focus and be alone, and then he'd feel terribly lonely and unhappy. And then he would go out and look for people to spend time with. But his friends would, of course, keep him from writing, and he would develop anger towards his friends because they were keeping. See, isn't this interesting? So he would be, when he was writing, he was lonely, and then he would find friends to keep him from being lonely, but they would keep him from writing, and he was a writer, and so it, around and around we go, right? And the interesting thing was Hemingway was married 4 times, I think, and he would get into these relationships with women. For this same thing would create a relationship and then destroy a relationship, because he would marry a woman that he loved, and who would make him help to get him out of his isolation, and then he would blame her for his not being a productive writer, and this would destroy their relationship, and then he would go on to, you know, so this is, we have this capacity to be really profoundly unhappy because we snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. You know, probably if you could look at your life objectively, you would say, I'm actually doing pretty well. I'm actually doing pretty well, you know? Probably, if you looked at your life, you would say, you know, I do a good job at work. I'm working in a job that's reasonably interesting. I have friends. You know, I have my Zen practice. I have other interests. You know, my life is pretty good. You know, probably if you looked at your life just objectively, you would be filled with gratitude for your existence. You know, I too come to Sesshin sometime feeling very dissatisfied with my life. And after a couple of days of Zazen, I'm sitting on the cushion thinking, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you for this precious life. You know, thank you for this opportunity to have lived. And I really feel it. It's like I'm really grateful to be alive. And I might start the Sesshin and be very, very unhappy with myself. And then 2 or 3 days later, I'm just thinking, what an incredible life I've had. See? Now, I would say that's a successful Sesshin, you know, because what's happening is you're instead of pursuing fantasies which make you feel bad, you're letting yourself rest in the moment, you know, and when you really are in the moment, all of these ghosts and fantasies can begin to dissipate, like a haze. You know, sometimes in the early morning there'll be a fog, and then the sun will come up and it will melt the fog. You know, sometimes Zazen can have the power to melt these projections and these, you know, it's like. We can get into these loops like Hemingway, where, you know, we just keep undermining ourselves, setting ourselves up for failure, and then despising ourselves for failing, right? Basically, Hemingway, didn't know how to negotiate his. I think my feeling is that Hemingway really just wanted to be loved, and writing was something he did to be loved. But it was, it's a love of distant admirers, not the love of somebody close to you, you know. So Hemingway couldn't work out this inner contradiction, but probably if he had done Zazen, I wish he had, you know, if he had done Zazen, I think maybe he would have been able to realize that his life was pretty much of a charmed life, you know. Hemingway wrote a really wonderful collection of short stories at the beginning of his career that made him famous. And then he wrote a novel called The Sun Also Rises, which was a massive hit. And then he wrote some other good books, but of course, every time he didn't write another massive hit, he felt like he tore himself to shreds, basically, because that means he's not going to be loved anymore. And so, you know, Hemingway would always be unhappy that he couldn't equal his early success. Now, you know, there are many people in the world who would say, my God, you wrote one book that everybody loves? That's fantastic, right? But Hemingway managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. So, you know, this is a deep mental habit that we tend to have. Maybe not everybody in the room has this habit, but it can become profoundly, it can make every moment of your life unhappy if you have this sort of self-judging as self despising mentality. And so, you know, Zazen is, I think, last night I was saying that I thought Sesshin was really amazing. It's like this amazing process. Because people come in here with a lot of distress. And by the way, your distress is likely to get worse rather than better during the first couple of days of Sesshin. This is actually the case. So, you know, basically, I have seen people come into Sesshin and they'll come and see me and they'll say, this is making me furious. This is making me angry. And I have pointed out to them, usually without success, that they were probably angry before they ever sat down on the cushion. I've heard people say things like, Sesshin makes me want to jump out a window, right, of a tall building. And you think, no, you came to Sesshin wanting to jump out the window. You're just now facing it, right? So you're just becoming aware that this is the burden you brought to Sesshin. It's not making you want to jump. You already wanted to jump. By the way, that's why you came to Sesshin, because you're trying not to jump out the window, which would be a good thing. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we begin to try to focus on the breath, we often confront our obstacles, right? And then we start doing the Hemingway game, you know. I need to be a great writer, but I'm lonely. I'll go with my friends, but then I'm not a great writer. Then I'm lonely, but then if I write, I'm lonely, etc. So we all have our versions of the Hemingway game, right? We find ways to destroy ourselves if we're not careful, because we construct these imaginary stories of success, and then we can't appreciate our lives. And if we can't appreciate our lives, we can't live with trust. The other day I was doing some research on a writer who was very well known. His name was Horgan, Paul Horgan. I'm sure you've never heard of him. If anybody's heard of him after the Tay Show, you can tell me. But I doubt I would be willing to bet $1 million, not that I have it, because I don't. But if I had it, I think you could confidently bet a lot of money that you've never heard of Paul Horgan. But at one time, Paul Horgan was a hugely popular writer in the war years, in the 1930s and 40s. He was a friend of a lot of distinguished scientists and intellectuals, and he published like 15 or 20 books. He wrote a lot about the American Southwest, and his books were all very, very well reviewed in like the top journals, you know. But the interesting thing is that nobody today has heard of Paul Horgan, and I was reading his autobiography, and it turns out By the time he died, all his books were out of print. You know, I just thought that was fascinating. Here's a guy who wrote and published book after book, and by the time he was dead, his books were out of print. Now you could say, well, if he were really a great artist, they wouldn't be out of print. But that's not true. I've read many really amazing books that are out of print, you know, and the writer should have been given the Nobel Prize but didn't get it, you know. This just happens sometimes. Well, my point is, you know, Paul Horgan could have made himself absolutely miserable in life, but he also had the chance to be really happy. You know, Horgan published all these books, and then they started going out of print. And toward the end of his life, he actually had, you know, financial difficulties because his books weren't selling. It's possible that in the end of his life, he was very, you know, unhappy because he thought generations would be reading his work and so on and so on. And he could sit around all day and brood and drink and be bitter, you know. But on the other hand, he could have said, gee, I published 20 books. I was reviewed in the New York Review of Books. You know, I've had quite a good life. You know, I lived the life. You know, I'm a novelist, and I live the life of a novelist, you know. I think that that difference, that ability to be happy, is quite important, you know, and it comes from being willing to trust in the moment, you know, being present in the moment. And if you just bring, you know, Zen is really just about bringing the mind back to the present moment over and over again. And so you come in, you sit down on the cushion, and you're thinking, oh my God, I haven't been promoted in 5 years. I'm a failure, an abject failure, right? Okay. So, you know, that kind of thing. Then, you know, basically, that's day one. You're sitting there thinking, I'm a failure. Why didn't I get that promotion? They don't treat me right. This is a lousy company. The boss is a bastard, you know, look at that other guy. He got a promotion. He doesn't do half the work. You know, okay, so this is what you're thinking. And then, you know, day two, you get up in the morning and you're too tired to continue that bullshit, you know. So you think, all right. I've been through this. Now I just have to survive. I just have to get through the next sit. And you're just trying to survive. And this is actually like a superior mode. You know, this is actually better than the other way of living, which is constantly judging yourself harshly. You know, if you sit down on the cushion and you just watch your breath, you can begin to notice the moment without the screen of thoughts and projections, and the moment can become quite beautiful, quite beautiful. After the Saturday sit, this most recent Saturday, I came home and I sat down at my desk to grade some papers. And I looked over at at my desktop, and it was covered with sunlight. And it just hit me. It was so beautiful and so deeply moving. And I thought, this is what happens when the mind is purified by Zazen. You know, I mean, I know that there are people who can enjoy sunlight who don't do Zazen, so I'm not saying that you need to, but I was not caught up in this mental baggage. I was just open to the moment in a very accessible way. And it was deeply moving, just the simplicity of light on the surface of my desk. And that's a difficult state to achieve, because usually we're going around and around and around in the circle in our head. And as I say, day one of Sesshin often involves an intensification of our awareness of this process. So people can become uncomfortable at Sesshin on day one, not just because their legs are hurting, but because they're they're confronting some of these obstacles, which can include, by the way, reactions to pain itself. Sometimes when we're sitting and we're in pain, we've been physically victimized, and the experience of pain is unbearably difficult to work with, you know. And that can produce great distress and even like narcolepsy. Years ago, I was practicing with Webb, and we had a guy in our Zendo who actually would fall asleep on the cushion. He would get onto the cushion, and about 20 minutes into the sit, he would actually keel over. He would actually just fall over, and after a while, you'd hear this. And I didn't understand his story. You know, I was the jikijitsu. I was in charge of discipline in the Zendo. In most Zen centers, people carry a stick. There's a guy who carries a stick around. And if anybody moves, he hits you with a stick. And so people are not supposed to move. My job was to patrol the rows. So at the beginning of each sit, I would get up, and I would walk slowly down each row, and I would look to see if anybody was moving. This is a part of Zen practice. We don't do it here, but by the way, if you moved even a muscle, you know, you would get yelled at, and somebody would hit you. And so basically, I was trying to be a very good jikijitsu. I was very strict, and I would walk down the aisle, and boy, if you moved, you know, so. Anyway, at this particular session, I think we had about 26 people or something, and so there was two long rows in our Zendo. And I came to the end of the Zendo, and there's this guy, he's just passed out on the cushion, and it's and I thought, what the hell, you know, sleeping, you know. So I woke him up. And I said, wake up! And I banged my stick. And then I went, that was going up one way. And then I came down the other. He was fast asleep again. And so I hit him with the stick. You know, it's a special kind of stick with a flat head, like a paddle. And you hit people on the meaty part of their back. And it makes quite a frightening noise. But it doesn't leave a bruise or cause any obvious injury. And so I hit him, you know. And then I went back and sat down, and by God, if he hadn't gone back to sleep. So I didn't know what to do about this guy. But it turned out later, after the sesshin, that this person had been physically abused by his father to the point where he would actually pass out. Right? So when he had pain on the cushion, he couldn't deal with it. He would go to sleep. He was a narcoleptic. But even if you aren't a narcoleptic, you know, you might not have the ready resources to deal with physical discomfort. You know, you might just crumble. Because maybe you've experienced physical abuse in the past, or, you know, the experience of pain makes you relive a certain moods that you might not remember what created those moods. You know, you might just remember the mood. So being in pain might put you in a very bad place. You know, and so that's difficult. That's a difficult thing to deal with. You know, you can always sit in a chair in the Zendo. Zen is not about being in pain, and it's not about being tough. On a scale of 1 to 10, when I'm in my worst pain, it's about a 3, okay? So when you see me sitting over here and I'm not moving, it's not like I'm in excruciating pain. Usually I'm actually like really happy, you know. So, if you're in excruciating pain, it's okay to adjust your posture, and it's certainly okay to sit in a chair, okay? If pain is something that plunges you into despair and it plunges you into like a state of abjection where you feel yourself simply falling apart, you're going to have to work with that somehow in life, right? Because it's not really possible to avoid pain. You have to develop strategies for dealing with that. And sooner or later, I think the best strategy is to try to focus the mind on the present moment. So basically, when I sit down on the cushion, I start watching my breath, and I try to focus very intensely on either my koan, which might be my breath, or a particular turning phrase. Or sometimes I'm just trying to be aware of moment-to-moment awareness, mindfulness, you know. So basically, if I'm, say, listening, I'll just listen and just note sounds, and I want to bring my mind back there. And very quickly, thoughts dissipate, and I begin to feel very safe and connected. And this safe, connected place is called samadhi in Zen. And you can work through your discomfort and your pain and your projections and get to this place. And then, you know, the moment is very therapeutic. You know, actually, being in the moment is very therapeutic. Because it's actually a wonderful place to be. And if you can just stay, you know, most of our problems come from not being able to be 100% in the moment. In fact, all of our problems come from this. So basically, when you practice Zazen, the solution, you can sit in a chair if the pain is causing you to become unstable psychologically, or if it's producing great distress. You know, just sit in a chair. It's not a disgrace. Everybody in the room has done it. But being in abject pain is not constructive. But sooner or later, everybody needs to develop strategies for dealing with their pain. And there's many different kinds of pain. There's physical pain, there's psychological pain. Running away is not a good strategy. Running away from pain is actually like a losing proposition. Because you will be running forever. And also, it is better to face our fears than to run away from them. Yeah, because if we face them and work through them, then we can be in this beautiful moment, which is such a wonderful place to be. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, "What is the living meaning of Buddhism?" And Zhao Zhou said, "The cypress tree in the yard." See, that's a beautiful answer. There must have been a cypress tree in the yard. So somebody's saying, "What is Buddhism all about?" And Zhao Zhou could have said, "It's about reincarnation," right? Or he could have said, "It's about encountering enlightened mind." Or he could have said, "It's about meeting Buddha face to face." But what he said was, "What is the living meaning of Zen?" And he said, "That tree out there, the green tree in the courtyard right now, is what this is all about." So Zen is all about being in the moment, 100%, without judgment or any kind of expectation. And even though that might sound less appealing than, say, floating through the air, or being able to walk through walls, or whatever, it's actually quite amazing. A cypress tree is always green. You know, this is often mistranslated. It's not an oak tree, it's a cypress. Cypress tree is evergreen. Every time we come back to the moment, 100%, it becomes this endless source of life energy, this beautiful life energy. So basically, being a sesshin is a great opportunity to work through our obstacles and encounter a different, and to begin to live a different kind of life. Without these barriers, we can experience life very richly and fully. Sometimes life is difficult. Naturally, there are challenges, but there's no such life that, there's no life without such challenges. But it's possible not to be daunted, and not only that, but to be creative and genuinely joyous in our lives. And that's what Zen is all about. It's like living with real creativity, openness, and joy. And the way to get there is to work through our obstacles and be present in the moment. So everybody did a fantastic job this morning. You know, you might have not have sat to your satisfaction, but you sat to my satisfaction. I was really happy. So please let yourself off the hook a little bit and realize that if you're just sitting on your cushion and you're still here, you're doing a good job. And even if you aren't still here, you tried and you're doing the best you can. And tomorrow is another day, right? Tomorrow, another day. Some of you might have noticed Gary sitting on his cushion over here across from me, and he doesn't move for three sits. There was a time when Gary would come to Sesshin, and he would make it through day one, he would make it through day two, and then day three. I could almost set my watch. He'd be fleeing the Zendo. And he came to first Sesshin, and he got through day one, day two, and I thought, okay, good work. And then he came in to see me, and he said, I'm leaving. And I said, what? Leaving? And he said, yes. And I said, I tried to talk him into it, but he didn't give me a chance to talk him into staying. He just fled. Okay. So I understood. You know, next Sesshin, he's back. He's day one, there. Day two, looks like it's going to work. Day three, I'm out of here. This went on for a long time. In fact, you know, it would be like, uh-oh, it's day three. I suppose he's on the way out, you know, and I could see him drive off. You know. But at some point, you know, you just, driving off doesn't really help that much. It's a please drive off if you must, you know, but come back, try again, come back, try again. And one day, you know, you realize whatever I'm afraid of isn't that bad, you know. And then you have a different life, different kind of life. Doesn't mean you don't have problems, but you learn how to deal with your obstacles, and you work through them once, you can work through them a million times. And it feels so good to be free.